1 Corinthians chapter 15. Whether we get done today, I'm not sure. We'll be into chapter 16. And as I promised, our objective will also do an overview of 1 Corinthians, the letter 1 Corinthians. And then we'll be moving to the 2 Corinthians, which we'll have questions for. And you'll be able to put them in the folders which you have right now. And then we should be able to finish up this next quarter in 2 Corinthians. That's where we'll pick up this morning. We're going to be looking down about verse 29 and following. We spent some time there on verse 29 as we concluded class on Wednesday. And I'm going to recap, because maybe you were confused. Maybe you had some challenges with that. And it won't hurt us to look that over once more. All right. Before we begin class, we'll have a prayer. And I'm going to ask Brother Elliott, if he will, to lead us in prayer before we begin class.
Pray for all of us who are sick and unable to be with us, and pray that your health may be restored if that be your will. We ask thee, Father, at this time to be a teacher of the hour, that we may teach in such a way that we can learn much and apply it to our life. We pray, Father, for the church here, and pray now that you will forgive us if we've done anything wrong. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.
All right, remember
the sentence there in 1 Corinthians chapter 15 can give us some confusion. Doesn't matter really which translation you use, because it's not about the words. It's not about the phrases either at all. It's about punctuation is what it comes down to. At best, it might be thought that the personal pronoun them would be a challenge for us, especially since that's where we're stuck sometimes. You know, as was asked, you know, was he saying you're baptized for those that have died? And that's what it would sound like he's saying. But that's not what Paul is saying. First, as we've already noted, and Brother Miller brought up, that there's other places that will deal with that problem. And so we can't contradict the word. And therefore, that can't be the answer. But it has to be much, we have to decide that we're going to examine the text even beyond the what it can't be, and understand what it can be. So we have to stay within it. Remember how we discussed this last week. We talked about the different ways of looking at it, and it all comes down to whether or not you put a question mark or an extra one in there, or even if you don't, just understand it and take a break. In other words, pause. So here's how I did it. First of all, I'm going to read it from the ESV this morning. It says, in verse 29, else what shall they do that are baptized for the dead? Question mark. Okay, that's what it says. If the dead are not raised at all, why then are they baptized for them? All right, the King James Version is very similar to that. New King James, really very similar as well. Otherwise, instead of else, same punctuation. Now, let's change the punctuation and let's see if we can't understand it better. So otherwise, what will they do who are baptized? Question mark. So now if you stop there, then you're just talking of someone being baptized. So your question, right? Then for the dead? Question mark. Make another pause. Now you're dealing with the ideal of dead, but not necessarily those that were baptized in the previous, right? Now notice, they are baptized to belong, to be a numbered, that is, among the people who are never to rise again. You see that? Indeed, he says, if the dead do not rise at all, why are people baptized? Or persons? For them? You see how we're doing it? We're changing it up. We're just, all we're doing is changing the structure based on punctuation. I am adding a little bit more to help explain some of that. Are they baptized to be numbered among the dead who are never to rise again? It's kind of a commentary on that. Does that make more sense? They that are baptized, are they baptized so that they may remain dead or become dead again? That's what he's saying or asking. If that's the case, that means they are dead men and they will not rise again. That's the point. You will not rise again if you've been baptized to remain dead. You see, that's the whole argument he's making. Because remember, likewise, we discover what the answer is based in the context. Because the letter here, or this particular chapter, is dealing of the resurrection of the dead. They're saying no resurrection of Christ. Or really, first of all, no resurrection of the dead for themselves, and therefore no resurrection for Christ. All right, here's Christianity without resurrection. And that's what Paul is dealing with. He's not done with the argument. He has much more to say, as we'll cover this morning. But it's we might also understand verse 29 as a segue point or a transition point in which he pauses to bring a logical argument about resurrection and dying. The whole point of the need for resurrection is because you're dead, right? And you understand it in context to your death, not another's. Don't get hung up on them, you know, the other ideals. To understand that he is talking. And by the way, these personal pronouns sometimes are interchangeable. Some translations, for instance, I think even the King James, when you'll find passages, say, in Romans, when I think it's Romans 8 where we had studied last Sunday night, when talking of the Spirit, you will find and discover that some translators have put in it, itself, make it an impersonal pronoun. And so, oh, wait a minute, then the Spirit is not really a person, and so on and so forth. And people will make those arguments. I've had people that have made theological arguments about why the Spirit isn't really a person of God, just on that argument alone. See, right there, and making a fast, hard rule. I promise you, I do not know a great deal about Greek, but what I have dug into to discover about this personal and impersonal pronouns, they're not so set in concrete in the Greek. The concept of itself, hisself, herself, so on and so forth. There is something that you can understand by those, of course, just like you would in any language. But the Greeks weren't as particular as I understand it as we are. Because what happens is the Greeks have a personal or a pronoun, but it's not impersonal. In other words, it's doing double duty. You got to discover whether you're dealing with itself, herself, themselves. Well, depending on the plural and so on and so forth, you'll have that. But as far as whether or not you're dealing with a person or an impersonal object. So, again, don't worry about that, but think about it. If he is dealing with your resurrection, then it makes good sense to understand that he's saying, are you to remain dead since you have been baptized? And what sense would that be, right? You don't remain dead because you've been baptized. Your baptism, in effect, is a transformation by itself. Why do I know that? Why do I know the baptism is a transformation? It's in Paul, one of Paul's letters. Chapter 6, verse 3 and 4, but 4 in particular. What does 4 say? Right. You buried in water, right? You're buried in water in order to be raised to a new life. Just like, because that's the comparison, Christ was buried and he arose. You know, it's a transformation. That's the lesson. Certainly, it's a spiritual transformation. You don't come out a new individual physical person when you come out of the water. You look the same, except for being wet, as you were when you went in there. But you are transformed. It is a type of transformation. And so it shouldn't surprise us that it is very intricately connected to our resurrection. Now, that is, of course, one type of resurrection. A resurrection to a new person. But we're not done with the resurrection when we do that. We still have the final and last resurrection of which we're all looking forward to. And that's exactly what Paul is dealing with here in 1 Corinthians 15. All right. That being said, anybody have any questions at all about that? Explain the process of the resurrection of the dead. That was my ninth question on here. And this is where we get, again, a little bit more detail about the process, the transformation that we're dealing with. And Paul will deal with this in verses 35 through 49. It's a lengthy section. What is his illustration? That would be the first question we'll ask. What's the illustration that he uses? Right. There you go. So seed. We're talking about planting something and then hoping to receive something. All right? We plant seeds to receive fruit from it. Now, it could be that we're planting a beautiful flower, but you know there's a transformation. You know what a seed looks like, right? So be gardeners, etc. Does it look anything like the final outcome? If you actually are accomplishing the task, it will look nothing like that. In fact, the irony is that even though you know, as most fruited plants have, that same seed form may be inside that finished product. What is before that fruit? What comes up out of that seed? A plant, right? It's usually green by nature, right? Some of them are viney, some of them are stalks, etc. We know what corn does and all these other. We end up with a green plant, right? And it's going to grow up and it's going to keep flourishing. And it's amazing because typically you'll have one seed, maybe a few that you'll plant in one spot. And then what do you get? You get this beautiful leafy plant. And then by and by, what's the next thing typically? Fruit. You'll usually starts with blooms, a bloom that will kind of start opening up. You'll see a little bud come out like a flowered plant, typically, on most crops or most things, not all. But then it'll come out, and then the next thing you know, here comes right behind that. Once that bloom finishes its period of time, you know, probably pollination, etc., and all that, it'll fall off, and here's the fruit behind it. Now, you see the small part of that. You see the beginning of that, don't you? Right? The next thing you know, hopefully within enough time, a few weeks, you'll have the full fruit that you were looking forward to. All right, that's the process he's talking about. Again, we're still in transformation. But isn't it interesting? So what does he do when he talks about this process? What does that plant have? It has a finished product. Okay, first it's sown in. All right, why is it sown in corruption? Let's stay in the gardening analogy because we can understand that. You put that seed where? Do you realize the process of that seed is a dying process? It might sound confusing to us because, I mean, how could that be? That seed is put into the ground. Now, eventually you want a fruit, but it's a corruption process. Because you're using fertilization, I know, to cause that thing to grow. But you're putting it in the ground. What do you do when you put something in the ground? You bury it. Therefore, you bury it. We're talking about burying dead things. You don't bury live things. So it's a dying process. Because if that seed does not die appropriately, then what happens? No plant. No fruit. No nothing. You probably have planted seeds. I know I have. You guys may not have. Let's just say I have. And hey, nothing coming up. It didn't come up. I did something wrong. There isn't the right process in there. There's fertilization. There's something missing. Nutrients, etc. But that thing, that plant has to go through a process, or excuse me, that seed has to go through a process of dying in order to produce the result, that plant. That plant can only come when the seed dies. All right, that's what he's talking about. Well, think about it. This beautiful plant, as we want to call it, Christianity or fruit, this Christian body, not the physical body, but this Christian soul, spirit, body, as we're using here in analogy, cannot live without dying. There's the only way that I'm going to become a Christian, and that's through the process of dying. So he will talk about it in terms of that. Just as all of creation carries the same process. So one body has its own glory. Once it grows up, he will continue to talk about the process of glorification. For instance, you put the seed into the ground. Say the watermelon seed. What's the watermelon seed's glory? No, the vine's not even the glory. What's the glory? That watermelon you pick out of the fruit. When, that's the end glory. I mean, that's the objective. Because if you had a beautiful vine and nothing else, as pretty as that vine may be, it does nothing for you, doesn't it? Because your objective was the fruit, correct? So that is what you're striving for. You're striving for the glory of that fruit. That fruit, have you ever went out and looked at an amazing fruit? I mean, say a watermelon, as we're still illustrating, and it's this large, and you never expected one to be this long, you know, 3-4 feet long, which is next to nearly impossible. You might get them 18 inches, you know, a foot to 18 inches or two at the most. This is a 3-foot watermelon, and it's about this deep. You see, the glory is what we're dealing with here. That's what we're describing. The glory is that fruit. All right? Each, as he talks about, body has its own glory. The seed that you plant is to produce one glory. All right? It's the order of creation. So does man have glory, just as God in and of himself has glory. So you start with the seed, you get the plant, then the glorious state, that is the fruit. Then the body of man is sown in corruption and is raised in incorruption, a glorious body. All right? Now, each one of these in their proper order, of course, has an end, except for man. Now, you see that? Each one of the illustrations, whether it be the celestial, as he will talk about, the universe, the stars, the various things that you can see, they have their glory, but they also have their end. Same thing true with this great plant that we would plant. The fruit would bear and it would be glory, but it will end. On the other hand, his objective too is to show you not only the distinction between those things that, all those things that have their glory and where they start, but to show you ultimately, as he drives to the end, that your glorious state has no end. Now, we're already presuming some things here, by the way. Keep in mind, we're not suggesting that all resurrected persons will have a glorious end. We've already discussed that, but that's not Paul's discussion here. Keep that in mind. When he talks about resurrection, while it also deals with the question of all mankind's resurrection, his primary objective is to talk of those Christians' resurrection. We would have to go to another place to discover the resurrection of the dead that are condemned. Primarily, as we said before, John chapter 5, verse 28 and 29. In fact, we've alluded to it several times in this. Let's turn over there. Again, keep in mind, Paul's discussion is not about resurrection of the condemned. God, and we'll talk about, well, it is dealing with that toward the end. We'll talk about that, but let's just go over there for right now. John 5, verse 28 and 29. Jerry, would you read that for us, please? All right, very good. So there you have it. Now, again, we will discuss at the end of this section the conclusion about the resurrection of the condemned. But nonetheless, you see what he's doing. He has built the case. In fact, if you think about what we've been arguing about the construction of verse 29, here's your motivation. You want to have a motivation for appreciating your baptism, You ever thought of that? I mean, you think, well, this is in, it's not even directly related to it, but it really is. Because he says, why are you baptized if you're not resurrected? Why are you baptized if you're not looking forward to a resurrection? If you rise a dead person, why do that? Here's your motivation. First of all, you need to know the facts of the matter. He says the facts of the matter is there's glory for every living thing. Did you know that? Everything has a glory. But some, verse 35, one will say, how are the dead raised? So they're adding the argument after, you know, the fact, as he's saying hypothetically, some would say, and maybe they're not hypothetical, maybe these are questions that have been asked. When he says, if you've been baptized, in other words, you've been put in the under the water, in other words, put in, under, you've been buried, then why aren't you raised to be alive? So, but they're not even willing to stick with that. So they will say, well, then how are the dead raised? In other words, they want to know why. And with what manner of body do they come? So there's two things. How are they raised and what are they raised with? And then Paul says what? Verse 36. What does he say? Yeah. Right. Go ahead. Go ahead. Finish. So all flesh is not the same flesh. There is one flesh of men. There's another of the beast. Saying the way that we're all created, right? Another has a flesh of birds and another of fish. We see the animal kind. We see the mankind, don't we? We're not done. There's also, he says, talking of the universe, the stars and the heavens and the planets, etc. There's a celestial body. We call sun and moon and stars, etc. And bodies that are terrestrial. What's terrestrial is that thing, those things upon the earth. The earth has a body, right? Those things that are in this realm, things are in the realm in the celestial. There are also, he says, but the glory, notice, that's what he says in verse 40. But the glory of the celestial is one, the glory of the terrestrial is another. There is one glory of the sun, another glory of the moon, another glory of the stars. For one star differs from another star in glory. He's even breaking it down to say that within the context of a kind, there is a glory specifically assigned to each individual of a kind. It isn't just enough that man has glory, the animal has glory, and so on and so forth. But he says within the context of the kind, each individual has glory. That's the beauty of this text. You want to know about the resurrection? We talk about glorification. We're talking about glory. And you want to think that there is no resurrection? Just look around you. And look at the glory that each one of these things or persons or what have you have. Notice their glory. Understand them in the process. And you then will understand the resurrection then. So he says in verse 42, so also is the resurrection of the dead. All right? That's critical. That if you want evidence of a resurrection, look at each of the constituent elements that he talked about. Look up into the stars. Look at the sun. Look at yourself. Look at your fellow man. Look at the plant life. Look at the animal kingdom and its various forms, whether it be fish, bird, mammal, reptile even. Every living thing has a glory. Every living thing has a glory, which is a testimony to the story of the resurrection. All right. Now, of course, we understand when we come to man, his intent and his end will be to explain how our resurrection is one, that will result in everlasting. There will be no glory, our glory will not be one that will be terminated. And that if we did describe the resurrection in the sense of the plant life, that the glory of that fruit is terminated at some point. So it has an end, right? But on the other hand, he will continue on and he will give you good evidence to show you that our resurrection is one to look forward to. And it's, again, laid out beautifully to talk about glorification. Remember that. Any questions? All right. How fast will the resurrection come? That's right. Verse 52. The moment of twinkling eye. It's not a blink of the eye, is it? Maybe you've heard a preacher talk about the difference, and maybe you know people that know. Blinking is one thing, and that's pretty rapid. This word twinkling is greater than blink. It's faster. I don't know how you'd measure it. In other words, I don't know that you could. But if you can imagine the twinkling of an eye, then it's faster than that. That's probably the best we can come. As Brother Miller brought up, just pretend that we're discussing the speed of light. Because that's what you're dealing with. It is quick. He says this resurrection process is not going to take the time that those things that are raised to stay in corruption do. Think about that. We've already talked about the plant. We know that we're not going to immediately get fruit from the seed that we put in the ground, correct? All right. Think about the birth of humankind as God's designed it. It don't happen in a moment. Some mothers through pregnancy probably wish that it would be done and over with, but it takes time, doesn't it? 9 months. Poor old elephant takes 2 years. So you get the point. And it takes time, doesn't it? Every part of creation that we can observe that goes through a process of birth, you know, dying and living, etc., the seed and so on and so forth, we can appreciate. It's not quick, is it? All right. This resurrection, the moment and the twinkling of an eye. Now, think about the days of creation. Though it was very fast, arguably very fast, considering what we see, how long did it take for each component part? Well, he spoke it into existence, but he did it in one day, then he did another. I'm not saying it took that length of time, but notice how he showed us, though we would not observe it. Man could not observe creation. Notice that man observes all creation when it's complete. He's on the end of the scale, right? He knows everything's been created. He didn't get to watch it. And it is true, he spoke it into existence, so we don't need to make more of it than necessary. But it was that he did this day, then he did these things this day, and so on and so forth. But what we're describing here carries us all the way to the end and says very plainly, the glory that you seek that's incorruptible is going to happen faster than the speed of light. Faster than that. It's faster, as he says, the twinkling of an eye. Okay? It's important. What does Paul say to do considering the certainty of that resurrection? All right. So we understand that we have something to do in respect to that. It's not about us sitting around waiting for the resurrection. We don't have time to go through it. But go to the letter, First Thessalonians, and you'll discover the challenges that they were having with the resurrection themselves. They were wondering about whether or not the ones that had died before them, if indeed they would be resurrected. In fact, they were fretting over the fact that they might miss it. They were expecting it in part to come very soon. For whatever reason, they come to that conclusion. And so they were waiting. They had stopped working. They had stopped doing things that they needed to do. And they were waiting for the resurrection. At the same time, while they were waiting for the resurrection, they kept pondering whether or not those that had died before them would miss out. They had a misconception. They thought that maybe you had to be living and breathing, and the resurrection not only was coming soon, but it would be only for those that are walking this side of the earth. So they were worried. Paul says, don't be worried about that. The resurrection that you're looking forward to depends on, as Brother Miller said, your steadfastness, your immovability, in the sense that you are grounded, but you're constantly in the work of the Lord. Friends, that's a good study by itself. You want the resurrection to come? You really want to look forward to and enjoy that day? Get prepared for it. Get ready for it. Right. Right. Mm-hmm. Correct. Right. Yeah. That's right. So when you get down to the end of the seed, as Brother Miller's pointing out, and we brought up in John chapter 5, and we'll continue that thought as well, you will be raised with something that's imperishable, something that cannot be destroyed. The question will it be one of life or condemnation? So if you are looking forward to that resurrection, then you're going to be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord. All right? Now, what else is certain from God's perspective? Now, that backs up a little bit, because what we were talking about is the last verse. What is certain from God's perspective about that resurrection? Right. There is completion, finality, that there will be nothing left untouched by the resurrection. Now think about that statement again. There will be nothing left untouched by the resurrection day. God has to destroy all those things that will be against the resurrection, against life, as it were. And so here's what he says. Jesus has one work left. Do you ever think about that? Aside from returning in to receive us, he still has something to do. And that is to destroy death. In other words, the process of living and dying. Remember what we said about the seed. If it is to produce a plant, what will occur? Death has to occur. You know, that's true with all living things, humans and animals included. Don't get me into biology. I don't know enough. But that's the point, that there is a process of dying and to make something live. And really, the argument is much greater than one I just brought up, though that proves it. And that is that man, because he sinned, brought about the circumstances that causes God to need to destroy something. Death had entered the world because of sin. Can death go on perpetually? No. God can't have that. God's a greater creator than that. Now, it may go on for centuries, but it cannot go forevermore. There has to be a finality, and especially if he is going to say that you and I are not just going to be dead and that's it, or annihilated, whatever you want to say. If there is a resurrection, there has to be a conclusion to death, inevitably. Therefore, he says, I've still got one work to do. And that's how he uses it, using, of course, the quotation here. Notice, O death, where is your sting? O Hades, where is your victory? Now, death is the process. Hades is the description of the place of dead. If you want just a pure definition of the word Hades, it's the ideal of the place of the dead. Okay, without getting into the discussion of the Hadean world, etc. It's the place for the dead people to reside. And it's important because you have to understand that God hasn't enacted the resurrection, or the resurrection hasn't started yet for us. Therefore, there still has to be a place of dead, right? Why could Christ be the first fruit regardless of a place of the dead? Well, he was, but think about this. In order for, and this is a good point, I think, to understand. Resurrection for us will be the process that will allow us to have a final home, whatever that home is, whether it be heaven or hell. Okay? That's the bottom line is. You can't get these places without resurrection. These places are not entered in without resurrection. Okay? They're finality. Why do we have to have the body that he wants? So that we could reside with him forevermore. Okay. Why could Christ be resurrected before us? It's important. Well, let's get back to the... Okay, you die. How is it that you're resurrected? You don't have a resurrection. You don't have a resurrected body. Why should there still... Why does there have to be a place for the dead? Because... Well, that's true. But you haven't been resurrected yet. That's the point. It'd be like that plant. That plant's waiting for the final fruit, right? The glory. You ain't got it yet. So you can't be where you need to be, right? You have to stay. And it is, as you might say, a holding. But let's look at it where that is still in there germinating. But why would Christ not need to stay there? True, that he has a home. Guys, we don't need to forget. I mean, the argument is simple. Isn't his home heaven? Didn't he already reside there to begin with? He went home. He's our first fruits in resurrection, of course. But he's from there. You and I aren't. We're not from there. If you think about this, I mean, he, first of all, could be in the order, though that's how God planned it anyway. He could be in the order because he has a final place. In other words, if we understand the resurrection based on this argument about fruit and growth, the dead raising to become a glorified fruit or a glorified person or whatever, then it requires home. It requires a place. God, Christ is God, therefore he already had it. You and I don't. So in order for us to have resurrection, if he were to say that we were resurrected now, we would already have to be resurrected now. In other words, it already have to happen just afterwards. But he's saying there's still one to wait for, you see. You see, in every living thing, there has to be a place. There has to be a home. There has to be a final state of being. Okay? Now, for those that are created, that's the caveat, they're created for incorruption. You see that? Though he started off with that simple analogy of the plant, it only can go so far because it is not perfect in every way. That fruit is beautiful when it's finished. Let's take the watermelon. It's a beautiful hot day. Well, that watermelon seed we've already planted some weeks ago has grown into this beautiful watermelon. What are we going to do? It's already in its glorified state. What are we going to do with that plant, that watermelon? Yeah, we're going to eat it, consume it. And guess what it does? It decays the process. Whatever's left over will go to the compost or whatever we do with it. The stuff that we've eaten, we know the process, don't we? You see that? So we know the end of those. On the other hand, mankind was not designed for incorruption. For corruption. He was designed for incorruption. Therefore, there has to be a final state. If Christ was already God in the flesh, performing all that he did, he could be resurrected simply because he had a place to go, if nothing more. But there was much more to the story. He had to be our first fruit. But he had a destiny. And think about it. It makes good sense because he also had a place to go to come back for us to take us there likewise. So in the time being, before the final victory has been had, there has to be the place of dead things. The dead, in particular, of mankind. And therefore, man is waiting. Yes. Why? Because God hasn't enacted his final victory. And that will happen on the resurrection, in which he will make a victory of death and a destruction of the place of the dead. That's why it makes good sense. All right. Any questions about that? It hasn't happened yet for them either. Now, they've died, of course, but remember what he said. The resurrection will happen in the moment of the twinkling of the eye. That's what everybody, I don't care if you're in the, you're dead or you're walking upon this earth, you're still looking forward to that. Because that's where the incorruption has to come in. And God has to make an end to dying, death, and the place of the dead. All right. Any other questions? All right. Name three lessons of chapter 15. Three lessons from chapter 15. That's right. That's a strong argument. Mm-hmm. Everybody's going to die. Okay. All right. Yeah, if it's persons, as Brother Miller says, not just death, every living person, we're using person in very specific terms, will be resurrected. Not every living thing. We've already talked about its glory. It's been done. It does its process from seed to plant to consumption, and it's done. Its glory is over with. But every living person. We must live with the conviction that Christ was raised from the dead by the Father. If we cannot live by that, then Christianity has no hope for us. And I mean that sincerely, guys. If we don't live with the conviction that the Father raised the Christ, Jesus, then there is no hope. Because he already said we're the most pitied persons, aren't we? Secondly, we must likewise be convicted we will be resurrected as he was. Remember, there's no difference in this sense. Now, we may have our own body, because remember, each individual can have a glorified body. I'm not arguing exactly the same body. I can't even describe what that would look like. But I do know this, that each will be resurrected as he was. If not, we're hopeless. And our baptism that prepares us for that is a waste. And finally, and thirdly, we maintain the proper view, as we talk about, through a steadfast, always abounding in the work of the Lord attitude. If we don't do that, then the resurrection that we are that is coming for us will be one that we would not want, that we would decide we don't even want any part of, but we have no choice of. Okay? Keep those things in mind. Be ready for chapter 16 Wednesday.